Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to this Friday chat. I don't have my fireside at the moment, but I'm in a different location. But welcome. Just a couple of housekeeping notes. This is being recorded, so don't say anything that you don't want your grandmother or the New York Times to know. My guest this week is Ryan Close, who is the CEO and co-founder of Bartesian, a push-button cocktail maker, which is in the middle of its major sales push for the Christmas season this year. So welcome, Ryan.
Hi, Rita. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I love entrepreneurial stories. So just by way of background, so the way that you and I got to know each other was I was studying this Anheuser-Busch Keurig venture called DrinkWorks, which, you know, took the world by storm for a while and then just vanished like at the end of 2021. And here's your scrappy little company, Bartesian, which is actually executing against the concept that DrinkWorks was created to do. So I thought maybe just to get us started, tell us a little bit about your journey and what you were doing before Bartesian and how the idea came to be and what's happening now.
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, 8 years to market. We kind of laughed at ourselves that we were the slowest startup. You know, you read the books and it's like startups are supposed to be so fast and quick iteration. And man, it wasn't the case with us. It didn't feel like it when you're in it. It felt very slow. You know, it started in a garage in Canada. I mean, literally, right? So
that's
yeah, it was me and one other fellow. And you know, it was a couple of engineers that really had the concept of, hey, how do we, you know, if we can get a good cup of coffee in a hotel, then why can't you make a nice cocktail? And the value proposition was extremely strong considering folks love cocktails, yet, you know, when they were drinking wine and beer because it was easy, right? It was an easier solution because they didn't have the bitters, liqueurs on hand, the, you know, pineapple juice, often obscure, right, ingredients. So I love the concept and the idea. I bartended through college. It's how I paid my way through in Canada. And I was working in operations, sales and operations planning for kind of mid to size companies, grinding it out a million hours a week. And I've always been an entrepreneur, you know, and on the side, I've had side gigs, but my wife finally said, hey, you know what? I bless you to kind of go forward and you can go and basically quit your job, make no money, and we'll figure it out. And we had young kids at the time. And uh-huh. I really believed in it. And yeah, we that was in Waterloo, and you know, a few years of trying to figure it out, trying to scrappily raise money, you know, 25K here, 50K here, just to get working prototypes.
Mm.
And then get the prototypes, take them to retailers and say, hey, this is how it will work. Give us an LOI so we can go then take that to investors to raise more money, right? Mm. And then we'll get further along. And so that was the, I guess, call it the game for a number of years, just trying to move, you know, the rock higher up the mountain. And you know, eventually, well, here we are.
Yeah, well, you talk about yard by yard, right?
Absolutely. I mean, just, you know, trying to basically insulate the business enough and have enough cash that, you know, because it's very true what they say, right? Is you die. I mean, the number one reason startups die is they run out of cash, and it's just a non-option. So it's like, how do we make sure that we're not going to run out of fuel, but still move forward and get some traction?
Yeah, but what I love about your story, and you know, I teach entrepreneurship, right? And so in the late 90s, it was incredibly frustrating. In the last few years, it's been incredibly frustrating because all kinds of, you know, businesses with promises like I'm the Uber of fill in the blank, right? And even Uber itself is a problem, right? So there's all this money going into these ventures. And yet you look at them and you go, well, what's your plan to achieve profitability? How are you ever going to, you know, become a stable company? And yet companies like yours, which, you know, patiently create a market, find a following, find the people that can be influential, find investors, and gradually kind of make your way through, kind of get fly under the radar, right? They don't attract a lot of the headlines. And yet, to me, those are much more real businesses than a lot of these high-flying unicorn kind of things that are just pumped up by money with no place to go, right?
That's totally right. I mean, every dollar we took in was applied to, you know, move forward and bring customer value, right? And so It wasn't about, you know, how do we, you know, the gamesmanship of trying to pump up our valuation. It's just like, how do we get this into a consumer's hand, make them love it, not spend at all costs for growth, right? Like we happen to be one of the few, I guess, lucky ones, fortunate ones that grew because of demand, not because we were just spending, you know, wild amounts of marketing dollars to acquire customers just to kind of prove out that we could get customers. We really didn't spend anything the first year and a half on marketing. Like, and to this day, I mean, you're looking at essentially the social media manager right now. I mean, we don't have anyone full time, you know, doing Instagram strategy. And I mean, we're TikTok stuff. We're a very lean team, 17 of us.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to, you know, on track to do over 50 million in revenue this year, you know, as a very amazing. Tiny team.
Oh, that's amazing. So you were pretty recently at the Consumer Electronics Show, and a lot of people like us hadn't known about Partesian, discovered you there. Did that offer a big bump?
I wouldn't call it a bump. I would say, you know, I've been there, man, it's been like pretty much every year that it was operational for the last 7-8 years. And I don't attend a lot of the industry events. And I think that's a way that we've been able to conserve cash, because you can get sucked into those and you just keep going and going. But CES is one that I tell other founders and, you know, early entrepreneurs, it's worth the admission, because really all the decision makers are there. And if you're willing to go put the work in and run around, I mean, you literally don't stop that whole week, and you can be in the room with the right people very easily. And that helped us get some really great, partnerships over the years. It's significantly helped. Mm-hmm.
So maybe take us through the early days, because I guess you had this idea, you know, how can I make a great cocktail that's as easy as pushing a button on a Keurig machine, right? What did you do next?
Yeah, so, you know, we looked at, okay, how do we, again, prototype to make sure this thing works? There was a lot of meetings where we were, you know, bringing this very rudimentary product to, you know, huge hotel chains, and the product didn't work. It couldn't power on. And I'm sitting there with like all these suits behind me, and it was super embarrassing. And, you know, a lot of those times, man, you get one shot, like, you know, to get these people in a room, and we've blown a lot of those, but it's like, hey, you got to take it though. You just got to take the shot, because you might not never get it again. Right. And so again, I don't know if I probably would change a few things, you know, maybe I'd be a little more patient. But yeah, we had this concept. Okay, how do we bring it to life? You know, it was talking to a lot of people. I mean, we talked to thousands and thousands. We would do small events and little shows and little gatherings where we would get people to try the drink. And this was all like, hey, can we show up for free and we'll give samples of our cocktails? And, you know, we weren't paying. They would say, yeah, of course. Like, this is cool. Let's, you know, local play, you know, events. And we would just, you know, interview folks and say, okay, what would you pay for this? You know, what do you like about it? What don't you like about it? What do you think about the, and most of it was about the taste, right? Because everyone right away thought, oh, this is super cool. Oh, my friend, my cousin thought of something like this. You know, this is, you know, because of the Nespressos, Keurigs, Tassimos, this isn't some foreign concept of, you know, a capsule-based beverage system, right? So everyone got it instantly, but it's like, if the taste isn't there, it's going to be a gimmick. And we recognize that early on. And it's like, so we said, okay, hey, we could focus on the appliance and, you know, build up. And we did. We started to hire people, mechanical engineers and folks who have experience in China. Mm-hmm. And we tooled up in China actually to make our own, to make the appliances. We hand assembled, we brought them into Canada. We hand assembled our first wave of units. Right. And we just recognized early on, it's like, this is such a capital drain. You know, the margins aren't great on the appliance, right? Obviously. And hardware, you know, can be difficult there because of the working capital requirements, you know, as a small company. And then the fact that you've got to have all these resources, when at the end of the day, if the cocktail is not completely amazing, who cares about the appliance, right? I mean, it's a gimmick. Mm-hmm. So we basically licensed, what we did, we found partners who are experts at the hardware, and we were at like 95%. Like I said, we assembled and we shipped, you know, over 1,000 units that we did. Mm-hmm. But we decided to pass it on, basically like license the technology and the hardware to, you know, different co-manufacturers who can do it for us. And pay us a royalty, distribute for us, handle the working capital, handle the service and the sales. So it checked every box, and it allowed us to then focus completely on creating more cocktails, better cocktails, and building up that roadmap.
So that was a big shift though, right? Because you and your partner originally, like one did the hardware.
That's right.
Was that Brian Federer?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So, you know,
and then you were focusing on the capsules. So that can't have been without a lot of intense discussion, right?
It was. And fortunately, you know, he was very smart people. You know, we had another person that was another co-founder, you know, who ended up getting poached by Apple and is a, you know, senior engineer there. And again, it's all very amicable. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is no longer a hardware company. You know, they were mechanical engineers, right? And we were able to leverage the mechanical engineer wing at some of the, you know, the biggest facilities in the US. And we now have partnerships with Hamilton Beach Brands, who's, you know, been doing it over 100 years, Stanley Black & Decker.
I was going to say Black & Decker is doing this bed machine, right?
That's right.
And how's that different than the Bartesian machine?
Yeah, so it's a little more, I guess we'll call it utilitarian. So, you know, the Bartesian machine is extremely
beautiful.
Focused.
It's
beautiful, sexy, elegant. You know, it's something you're proud to put on your countertop. And not to say the Bev isn't, it looks great as well. And it works really well. But it's, you know, you actually put the bottles, it's very cool. You put the liquor bottles and you showcase them and there's lights. And you're right. And so instead of pouring it in like the Bartesian, it's glass reservoirs, very elegant, sexy. The way the Bev works is you take your bottle and there's a metal straw that puts in the port. And so you can really display, it's like a liquor cabinet that makes you great cocktails at a push of a button. So it's really slick, but it's, you know, in the way I look at it is it's more focused on, you know, the man cave, the bar. You know, whereas the Bartesian is kind of like everyday kitchen countertop, right?
Yeah, you better hope you don't, on your way to the kitchen in the morning before you've fully woken up, that you get the right appliance with the right button, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, I do think it's fascinating that that, you know, the people that actually make Keurig, I mean, your machine keeps getting called, oh, it's a Keurig for cocktails. So it's a very obvious concept, and yet they couldn't make it work. And one of the things I don't know anything about the inner workings of what DrinkWorks was, but one of the speculations I have is that they're a huge company, right? I mean, they're enormous. And you're a scrappy little startup. And so what's good for you may not be big enough for a company of that magnitude, right? So one of the things I wonder is maybe they just came to a realization that this thing could never be a big enough addressable market to really move the needle for two huge, huge, huge global companies.
Yeah. And I think, I don't think it was the TAM or the limit of the addressable market, because, you know, I know that there's other folks that are, you know, a heck of a lot bigger than us that are very interested and have kicked the door at concepts and tried to make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, the biggest liquor companies in the world and biggest beverage companies in the world are now, you know, involved in the space in some way or another because it is so huge. So mm-hmm. I mean, again, my thought is, I think you nailed it, is it's, you know, pressures on early results, I think, but more so than that, it's being manufacturing the appliance, and then, you know, is a very tricky challenge, right? And so it's tough for a company to be all things to all people. And so, you know, that concept, that product, like they were pretty much everything soup to nuts, right? Manufacturing the machine, the appliance, servicing it, selling it, handling warranties, you know, manufacturing the capsules, you know, and loading in the alcohol,
One of the differences, they actually put the alcohol in the capsule, whereas with the Bartesian machine, you don't sell the alcohol, you just sell.
That's right.
And then as I understand it, the Bartesian machine, you can dial up or dial down or make it a mocktail or, you know, whatever you like. With the capsule from DrinkWorks, it was just one thing, right? It is what it is.
You nailed it. I mean, and I talked earlier about, like, we talked to thousands of people literally and got their opinion on things. And we recognized early on that most people wanted the ability to change the strength settings. They felt that they, you know, cocktailing and cocktail culture people want to be involved. It's an experience. It's not just, hey, I just need my drink. I got to get my drink. Well, then just get a can of, you know, rum and Coke or Ryan Coke, you know, an RTD ready to drink cocktail. But for those who want the experience of cocktail culture, they want to have some involvement in that process. And so, you know, being able to select a light, strong, regular mocktail, being able to say, hey, you know what? I want Tito's in here in my vodka. I want to load that in. Or, you know, here's a certain bourbon I want to try with my old fashioned. I can, because it's going to be a smoky flavor. And so those are important. It's very, you know, it's an experience where the consumer is involved in the process versus just, you know, hey, here's your drink. Whereas the competitors, that's what it was.
That's so interesting. That's so insightful. And, you know, one of the things I really admire about the way that you've approached this is, you know, you must have felt a lot of pressure. I mean, three little kids, you know, a wife who I gather was doing her degrees or whatnot. Like, how did you keep it all together in those early stages, but maintain the patience to really do that learning, you know, that incremental month in, month out learning that was essential to coming up with this concept?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, I think for me, I never got too low and I never got too high. And I still keep that, you know, as kind of in my back pocket. And when I tell people and they're like, hey, what do you, you know, what's your suggestions or tips for new startup entrepreneurs? And I'm like, well, you know, hey, because it's always like, hey, you got to celebrate the wins, right? You celebrate the wins. And I'm not saying you don't, but, you know, do it for a minute and get going and don't get too overexcited about the wins because they come quick and often. And the losses come quick and often. And if you're fired up and, you know, stopping to, you know, do a parade every time you get a win, you're likely, you know, really in the dumps when you get the loss. Right. Mm-hmm. So for me, what helped is just to be even keel and recognize that they're both going to come. Let's just keep moving forward. You know, failure is not an option. Like that's just, it's not going to, and finding people, you know, who are as crazy as I am to join the team and investors that are like really truly believe in it to say, you know, hey, failure is just not an option. And everyone I brought on to the team had that same mentality. Right. And that's where, you know, we've just been able to continue just to march and break through walls. And of course, having a wife who's a psychologist, clinical psychologist helps me, you know, when I need, because of course we handle stress and we is a lot of stress and, she's been an incredible consigliere for me and, you know, even my kids, you know, throughout it's been 8 or 9 years and, you know, my oldest is 12. So, I mean, all they've known is Bartesian. And they're, you know, they're the big shareholders and they're stakeholders in the business. They care about everything.
How old is your youngest?
He's 9.
Wow. Yeah. So you had 3 kids pretty quickly.
We did. Yeah. Right over throughout this. Right. So, it's been, you know, and we moved the business from Canada to the US, right before launch. And, you know, here we are in late 2019, you know, in the summer of 2019, we moved to Chicago and of course, you know, COVID hit and, you know, we launched the business. And so we're all basically in this rental house in Chicago for a year and a half tripping over each other while dad's, you know, launching a business, like getting it to market. So it was very interesting, but I loved every minute of it. You know, looking back on it, I loved every minute of it.
Well, you know, you repressed the bad stuff, right?
it's amazing how the mind works, right? It's just
totally. What made you decide to move to the US?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we had some great investors, right? Beam Suntory, so Jim Beam, they invested early on and were very helpful with some getting us enough money to continue to, you know, roll that rock up the hill. And so they came in and I found myself every week coming up and going to their HQ and talk because there was so many different groups within Beam that we could leverage to help continue to move forward. And every time I was here in Chicago, I was finding it extremely valuable, right? And then I'm back home in Waterloo, Canada, and I'm kind of on an island, right? And there wasn't, no offense to Waterloo, Canada, it's a great ecosystem, great, you know, they really do support their startups, and it was amazing to get the business ready to launch, but we were launching in the US primarily, so it just made sense for me to be here. And then we had other investors, like the owner of the Cubs, Tom Ricketts.
Oh, wow. You know,
I got a meeting with him and, you know, the idea was, hey, let's get this in Wrigley Field, right? Let's get the Bartesian and Wrigley in the suites in the stadium. Right. Oh, and great. So he's like, all right, leave it with me in the owner's suite and I'll play around with it. And we got a it was like a Jimmy Buffett concert or something like that, the Margaritaville. And he's like, so I'll try it. I got some friends coming. We'll try it out. So a couple of days later, he calls me. He's like, can you come in and meet with me in my office? I was like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe the machine didn't work. I was, you know, a little nervous and stressed. He's like, he's like, listen, we had so much fun with this thing. It was the greatest time. We loved it. Everyone freaked out. He's like, there was, you know, we went through every cocktail. He's like, not only do I want to put this in all our suites at Wrigley, I want to invest. I want to get involved and be a big investor and be part of the ride. And so he did. And he's just a great mentor and leader in his own way, and been extremely successful. And so having someone like that in, you know, my network, again, it's like in one of our first meetings, he's like, this is, failure is not an option. Like, we are going to make this work. And so getting people like that on board again, who continue to push us forward was awesome. And then after that, it was, you know, Don Thompson, who was used to be the CEO of McDonald's. And, you know, I met with him and we're in a room, first meeting, I brought the Bartesian, he was aware of it. We made a couple cocktails for him, and he's basically said, okay. And he's a very big man. And he's like, you're not leaving here unless we get a deal. Let's get a deal. And we did a deal right there where he invested in the business. And since, he's followed on in two other rounds since that, you know, early stage. So.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Wow. But, you know, just to pick up on something you said earlier, like, this didn't happen day one. I mean, these relationships take a long time to cultivate. You have to demonstrate proof of concept. You have to show up, right? You have to be there. And I think a lot of people that think about entrepreneurship, right, they kind of get that wrong, right? They think it's, I mean, the stories we hear, first of all, they're all survivor stories, right? You never hear about the ones that didn't work out.
Good point.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. And then the survivors always make up their own narrative about what happened. And a lot of times that's not even true either. So,
because they remember different things. That's right. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. They remember it differently than it actually happened. Right. I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about what you look for in the people you're bringing on now, because, you know, you're at this really interesting stage where you've gone through the valley of darkness, you've done the yard by yard, you've grown it very patiently. Yeah. And now it looks like, you know, you may be on the cusp of taking off. I mean, we've got Christmas coming. So as we speak, it's November. Yeah. Big, big gift time. And this is a perfect gift product, right?
It's great.
So, you know, you could be at risk of a lot of people jumping on opportunistically, right? So you must have a pattern that you look for in the people that you bring into your circle.
Yeah, I definitely do. And in terms of, you know, yeah, back to just touching your point on the retail and holiday, like, we're also, you know, Walmart's just launching, you know, our Duet, which is our 2-bottle unit, and it's their Black Friday special. So, you know, rolling 3,900 stores across the country, across the U.S. Yeah. So they're, you know, it's a big deal for us.
How many units is that going to be?
Over 40,000. Units. Yeah. And it's a guaranteed buy. And they're like, we're going to need more. Like, this thing's going to, it's a, like a door crasher, right? Product. Uh-huh. So, like,
oh, how
it's
gonna fun. Sell out.
Yeah.
So
it's really exciting.
What are you going to do on Black Friday?
I'm going to go to some Walmarts and probably pick some, cause it's cheap. I can buy them cheaper in Walmart than I can get them. You know, that's the real deal.
Where are you going to be? Maybe I'll join you.
Yeah, exactly. Any Walmart.
I could see spending Black Friday with cocktails. Let's do it
for real. So, but back to your question on, like, what is it I look for, like, in team members? Again, it's, you know, you got to have some people who are a little different, right? I like folks who are, you know, look at things that have a perspective that are very optimistic. So, you know, because again, you talk about it, we touched on it, like, it's a ride, man. It's a grind, and it's not as glamorous as probably the TV shows and the movies show. You're up early, you're running around, you're carrying boxes in and out of meetings, you're like the old school, you know, sales rep, right? Like, just shoe salesman or shower curtain rod salesperson. Like, that's, for years, that's how I still, to this day, I mean, running around, I was just in New York, and I mean, I'm in and out of taxis and Ubers, and I've got boxes everywhere, and I'm meeting with press, and, you know, you just got to do it. And it's tough. So, you know, how can you do it and look at it positively, right? And again, how can people handle distress, right? Are they going to cave in and And are they unable to have a candid conversation? Like, you know, things move very quickly, as you know, right? You work with, and you are yourself an entrepreneur, like it moves quick. You need to adjust. And so how can you adapt when you're being told, you know, hey, this isn't working, or what you're doing is flawed. And here, like, so how can we, I'm not going to lead you to the answer. You need to come up with, you know, how do we fix it? Right. So, again, like the project you've been working on for the last 4 months is now completely changed, and it's now shifting to this, you know, can you handle that? Is that okay? Or are you going to, you know, have a meltdown and mm-hmm. be frustrated and pound your feet? And so it's people who just get that, you know, and I tell everyone when I interview folks, we're only 17 people, very lean. I say to them, I use those analogies. I'm like, are you okay if a project you're working on, like it could just stop and completely, or you could be pulled from it and you could be on something else. Like I brought on a head of finance early on, and a really smart fellow. And, you know, a year later, he was now, you know, he was a salesman. He's never done sales in his life. And he was selling into commercial, you know, into hotels and Hyatt hotels. And that's what he's still doing because he's so good at it. Right. And, you know, that's not what he signed up for, but he's, you know, he's got equity in the business. He cares about, you know, he sees the opportunity, which is enormous. And, you know, we've just, obviously the growth has been incredible. So it's like, hey, we're all partners here. We're all team members. You know, I don't treat anyone like we don't even use the word employees. Like I hate it. And it's not to be like some kitschy, you know, kumbaya, but it's like, we're all adults here. We're all professionals. You don't need to be here. Like, you know, you're not doing me a favor. We're all a part of something, trying to build something. But we all know we're all, you know, let's just take care of it. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's finding people who can get that, that kind of mentality.
I think that's fabulous. So we've got a question about how do you adapt? You know, how do you get people to shift when you think they need to?
Like on the team, like mm-hmm. folks on the team, how do we shift them out? Mm-hmm. Man, it's not easy. And I could probably ask you that question because I'm probably doing it wrong most times, but you know, I just talk to them like I would talk to anyone else who's a partner, and not, you know, I don't have a script or a pre-script. Like I'm very authentic. Right. And so I'm just like, hey, like, this is how I see it. Mm-hmm. First off, I don't proclaim like I know. I never believe. And I really don't think I'm ever the smartest person in the room. I'm a humble person who's just like, hey, I don't know the answer. And I really, and it's not an act. It's like, you know, I do not oftentimes know the answer. And it's like, so here's what I'm seeing. Am I wrong? You know, what do we need to do here? And that's how I approach, you know, working with a team. And, you know, I think they respect that. And who doesn't? That's just how I want to be treated. Right. And when I worked for CEOs in the past, and, you know, I liked when they would just let me, and they just relied on me to take care of my stuff versus treating me like, you know, a child. Right.
So, Yeah. Well, one of the things I think that we're recognizing now is this model of leadership where you're sort of up on a horse, waving a sword, telling everybody what to do, that, you know, in fast moving environments, you can't know. Like, right. As the leader, you can't know everything that's going on. So you really do have to be able to create these environments where people can operate without having to ask permission all the time and kind of make sense of the environment themselves. Right.
You're exactly right. And, you know, it's one thing I don't do very, I don't micromanage. I hate micromanaging for my sake, because I don't want to have to. Right. And if I have to micromanage, we've got the wrong person on the team. And I wouldn't, again, I put myself in people's shoes. Like, I would hate to be in a role where I'm, you know, constantly, okay, what's, give me an update here. What's happening here? What's like, I trust I get the team in here. You know, the fellows and the really strong group of people that we have, you know, young, hungry, you know, couple of ladies we just brought on from, you know, Booth MBAs and Kellogg MBAs that are, you know, they come in, they're just like, their eyes are like saucers, and they're like, give me any project. Like, I just want to attack and be positive. And it's amazing. You get to go and work with these people that are just that positive and excited, and really are the future leaders of the business. It's not going to be me. They're going to be running it, not, you know, and it's pretty cool to watch that transition.
That is fascinating. So tell me a little bit about scaling, because, you know, I mean, it's one thing to run an operation where you're kind of able to see everything that's going on and you're all kind of metaphorically in one room and it, you know, it's pretty straightforward. But now you're at a stage where, I mean, Walmart's a pretty big deal. I mean, this is, you know, you could really see this thing taking off. And I don't, I mean, I think Christmas obviously is going to be huge for you, but I don't see it as a super seasonal business. I mean, I think it's something that, you know, you could see all year long that interest. And so how are you preparing yourself sort of mentally for this scaling challenge? Because what I hear from a lot of founders is when the business is really small, right? And you can sort of see everybody in one room, that's like one phase. But then when you have to start moving into a phase where you actually don't have everybody in the room and you're sort of dispersed and you got to kind of count on systems and processes now rather than just everybody knowing what's happening because you're all kind of the same. And are you thinking about that? How do you prepare for that?
Yeah, well, I have a unique vantage point, and Rita, I could be completely wrong here. So, and that's the beauty of it. We'll find out as time goes on. So, you know, I wouldn't call it advice, but you know, one thing I look at is, you know, and maybe it's because we launched this company within COVID, so we weren't in the same room, we weren't working, you know, we were always, you know, siloed to some degree, right? And you know, God, how many Zoom calls, like, you know, we like enough. So, and I stopped doing video Zoom calls. Like, okay, I don't need to see you in video to have a conversation for 12 minutes. Right. Like, let's just, you know, quick, what do we need to do? Let's move on. But you know, my hot take on it is, you know, I'm in somewhat of a believer in silos for small companies that are scaling, because otherwise it's that kind of, you know, I got it. He's got it. And the balls gets dropped. Whereas if it's very clearly, hey, I own this, I'm, you know, this is my piece of this business and I need to figure out who I need to hire for it, what the systems and processes are, you know, who I need to work with within the company that are my, you know, key stakeholders. And that's how we operate. And so like, you know, my head ops, Mike, you know, who's running supply chain, it's like, hey man, like QA, we need QA. Like, you know that, he knows that. So he goes and he finds people that he needs to hire and that do certain QA on, you know, the appliance that Hamilton Beach makes, right? Because we definitely trust them, right? And they do an amazing job and they're incredible, but at the end of the day, it's our brand. Mm-hmm. So we need to be, you know, on top of it. And so that's really, you know, I guess to sum it up is, you know, some degree silos are critical in the early stage of scaling because you need to have folks that just completely own that area. Now, as we get larger and larger and larger, you know, you're right. There's so many moving pieces and parts. And if everyone's kind of got their head stuck in the sand in their own space, things are going to break down and there's going to be some, you know, wasted time. So we're in that stage now where it's like, all right, the silo has worked to date. We now probably have to start doing a little more cross-functional, you know, meetings and bringing on new folks. And that's where, you know, I hired a few product managers. We've never done that before. Like we've really been like, okay, we need someone to do all our operations, so we've got Mike, right? We need someone to do all our finance, so we've got Tom, right? And so it's okay, we actually need smart people who are hungry that can come in, saturate themselves with knowledge on how the whole business works. And that's really what I tell them. I'm like, I don't want you to actually take on any certain own any projects or tasks yet. Just attend every meeting you can, learn and understand the context. And then you will get projects thrown at you intermittently. And without the context of how everything works, you're just going to spin your wheels, right? Like you're just going to be wasting time. And it's like, oh, wow, why are you working on that? Like this is, you know, Stanley Black & Decker's doing that, or we can't do that because X. Well, it's like, well, if I knew that, I wouldn't have wasted, you know, 3 weeks working on this project.
That
makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things they talk about at Netflix, for example, is the creation of context that if you really provide people with, you know, why we're doing this, what the goals are, what the, you know, what's the rationale for certain decisions, if you give people that, right, then they can operate fairly independently. I think that's interesting. So when they first come in, do you have an onboarding process? Yeah, kind of casual at the moment, or
zero onboarding process. It's go find yourself a laptop and figure out where you want to work, and you know, we'll talk when we talk. Like it really is like, because again, I'm trying to bring on people who are all very independent workers and get that. Hey, and this is I was nervous, you know, going into the startup world because it's like, and I was, you know, I'm a confident, very confident person, but you have nowhere to hide when you're in these little tiny businesses. You can't, you know, oh, this division of this department, like it's all you, it's all, you know, can you deliver? right? Mm-hmm. Can you, you know, take a task and execute? And mm-hmm. I would say most people can, right? I mean, and all of us can, I would say, you know, but it's, do you believe in yourself? And are you willing to kind of shatter the excuses and get rid of them and just say, hey, it's me, believe in myself and move forward. And again, I sound like, you know, maybe cheesy or whatever, but I really do believe in it, that you just, you got to be given the opportunity in the air, right? Like give them oxygen to be able to, you know, smart folks who actually want to do really well. And that's everyone, right? Everyone wants to do well. Give them the space to do it and learn and grow. And so that's what we do. And man, it's worked so far. We've just got, I'd love for you to meet the team. They're really.
Oh, sign me up. I'd love it. I'm very interested in your story. I think it's great. Were there any big surprises when you look back? I mean, I'm sure there were. Any journey has lots of twists and turns. I mean, myself, I'm on my third tech company for the software I'm trying to build. The team's turned over like 4 times.
Yeah.
it's been
wow
6 years for me, right?
So. Is that right?
Same thing, right? You know, but it's like, I know there's a desire. In my case, it's you know, people need tools to battle uncertainty and they need tools to build new things. And so we're trying to do that. But again, right. You know, like I'm very clear on what I think the outcome should be, but boy, oh boy, the path has been winding.
I bet. Sounds like it. That's incredible. Yeah. That, you know, there's been definitely been lots of surprises and lots of, you know, we didn't, you know, our objective early on wasn't to be an e-commerce business, right? That wasn't, you know, my skill set. It certainly wasn't any of the early people in the company's skill set. We had very little. And, you know, today that's our primary business. And I would say we're an e-commerce, you know, that's 80% of our revenue is e-commerce and maybe more, probably, you know, until the one it's 90, right? It's, and so, and again, that's the nature of the channel management strategy for us. Mm-hmm. You know, we had X amount of machines that we could sell and the demand was so high. Why sell in a lower margin channel that, you know, you've now got to rely on the big box retailers to properly, you know, manage and display and educate mm-hmm. where, you know, we could sit behind our laptops and get some smart people and agencies to say, okay, how do we communicate the value proposition and get to the right people and measure our cost of acquisition, right? Mm-hmm. Properly. And it's like, okay, well, man, we can do this. We don't need to take on gobs of inventory and risk, right? We can, you know, have limited inventory. So not a lot of overhead, find out who our customer is, find out what it costs to sell it to them mm-hmm. and have a better relationship with that customer, right? Mm-hmm. Because if they buy it from a store, they've got a relationship with that store versus they come on a Bartesian.com. Mm-hmm. They're now in our ecosystem and then we can, you know, help them have a better experience with the product.
Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah. A direct to consumer company.
Direct to consumer company. I mean, we really have started out as, and the concept was like, oh, we're going to sell in, you know, all the big stores and we're going to be a retail product. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's really been, you know, until this Walmart and we've done you know, rollouts at Williams-Sonoma and Macy's and that have been very successful, QVC, Costco, all those. And we still continue to do it. But again, it's I'm going to say 85-15 split to direct to consumer or, you know, either Amazon or Bartesian.com.
Well, that is so interesting because right now, you know, I mean, I would say I date it to about 2010 when I guess it was Dollar Shave Club. It was really the first.
Yeah.
Direct consumer company that
literally
took on, you know, established incumbents like Gillette. And then there followed just wave after wave after wave of these direct to consumer companies, you know, Casper and mattresses, dog food, and I mean, you name it. Now what you're seeing is sort of, you know, strategy 101 still matters, right? You still need entry barriers. You still need some kind of secret sauce. You need some kind of differentiation because these businesses are so easy to stand up, but now they're also, you know, very easy to copy. But it strikes me that you've got kind of a different thing going on, like not to be punished about it, but you've got a different recipe for success that I think would be very hard for others to replicate.
You're right. I mean, it's one thing if you have selling a pair of glasses or a razor, and it's a same type product and you gotta, you know, okay, well, it's all about the brand and it's all about how I communicate that brand messaging, right? Honestly, for us, and this is kind of a knock on myself because I'm the one who's done a poor job of this is, you know, brand development. We've kind of just been like, hey, we've just got this incredible product. And it's, you know, we used to early on kind of like oh man, when people are like, oh, I love your brand, like your brand is so great. And it's like, wow, you know, we haven't really focused on that. It's really been all about the product and ensuring that the customer, you know, knows how to use it. It works great. They love it. They have a great experience with it. And so now, even today, you know, again, I've said about the social media manager, like we just don't focus a lot on that. And we should be, you know, and we just recently are spending a little more time with, like, and I've like been completely opposed. Like, we never would give one penny to influencers. Like, we're just like, we're not doing influencers. Like, cause again, with the beauty of when you have a high demand, you can be a little picky, right? And say, oh, I'm going to, or bullheaded, maybe you'll call it. But we've adjusted, right? And now we're like, hey, you know what, this is the economy, you know, that influencer economy is a huge driver, and to, you know, completely ignore it, you're being short-sighted. And so you gotta, you know, we have to test and iterate in all different areas and channels, and, you know, TikTok.
You have a lot of fans. I mean, yeah. I was, you know, in preparing for this, I was sort of doing a little scan of the universe related to Bartesian. You have people making videos, you have people doing online reviews, so maybe without recruiting them, but you've got a lot of people that are very interested in your product.
It's amazing. I mean, if you go to TikTok and search, you know, Bartesian, and, you know, by highest, like, you know, by most liked, I mean, the numbers are incredible. Like, your thumb will get sore how many videos are out there. And I think, you know, part of the reason we've had that, you know, magic sauce, I would say, is we've always been authentic. Like, we're not a bullshit business. We don't say things that, you know, just to say them or because it sounds cool or hip, or like we treat, you know, I talked about how we treat our team members like their partners. Like, that's how we treat the customers. Like, hey, this is what it is. And, you know, sometimes I'll get in battles with customers, and if they, you know, and it's like, hey, I'll respect your feedback, but what about this? And let's have it out and talk about, you know, what it is that you don't like, or what it is you'd like to see, and does it make sense, right? And how can we still supply you with incredible product, but still stay in business and continue to, because it's always a trade-off, right? Like, okay, yeah, we can drop the price, but then are we able to make more? Like, we're rolling out, you know, 12 new cocktails this holiday. That's a lot of innovation for a team of 17. And our STIR team, you know, we have a STIR team that stands for Science, Tech, Innovation, Research. And they came up with that on their own. And
I love that.
And the STIR team, you know, develops these world-class cocktails. It's like just unbelievable. The quality, they're sourcing liqueurs from Italy and blackberries from Texas, and they're bringing it all in the US, and they're making this incredible cocktail and delivering it to the consumer for a couple bucks. So the value is incredible, right?
Where do you actually make the stuff?
Yeah, so Wisconsin and Colorado.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah. So you are very distributed.
Yeah, we really are. We've got, you know, three different facilities that, you know, we're running around the clock, and we've got a new one being set up in Northern Italy right now to supply the Europe.
Very cool. So now you're going global.
We are. We're rolling out a soft launch in the UK late November this year. So we've got, you know, Amazon and likely another, you know, luxe retailer that'll launch, you know, small launch, there's a lot of demand there. And so we'll put a few, you know, small level inventory there, and then we'll start expanding into Germany, Spain, Italy, et cetera.
And is the original idea, this idea of I'd love a cocktail when I arrive at a hotel, did that ever materialize as a big part of your business?
It was materializing, and then COVID hit, and, you know, 90% of the companies, you know, the hotels we were working with were laid off, or, you know, and so we had some incredible traction early on with American Airlines, Hyatt Hotels. And obviously, since the resurgence, that's, you know, it's hotter than ever. We're full flying. Like, we're the president of Hyatt's on our board, and the reason he's on our board is because he believes in the product, and we've been in a beta program with them that's been going incredibly successfully. So we'll be launching out, you know, through Hyatt's hotels. Oh. We've got a contract with Radisson, Comfort Suites, Aramark. So Aramark Delaware North, who manage all the concessions and stadium suites so we're in over 50 NFL and Major League Baseball stadiums in the suites right now.
That's amazing.
And yeah. So that, you know, that B2B business will likely overtake our consumer business in the years to come because of the LTV, the lifetime value of those. They're just going through a lot of capsules, right? Mm-hmm. Per night. Sure. You got to think some of those stadiums have you know, 150 nights a year are having an event.
Right, right. Yeah, I could totally see that. But it's so interesting. You know, what's fascinating to me is like all the rule books say you've got to focus on either consumer or business or, you know, mass market or whatever. And you seem to be just gaily flouting all those rules.
I never believed in that because I thought we could, if you have the bandwidth and you can find a way to test in different channels, I mean, you always have to be testing and always be pushing. And, you know, and again, I think the mistake is made when you go too deep. Like I talked about a soft launch in UK. If I took our team and I said, okay, now we're going to do everything we're doing here in the US now in UK, and we're going to go heavy and hard, that would be a mistake. Right. And because we're now taking limited resources and focusing them in too many areas. Right. So I took a skeleton crew of the team and said, hey, this is our little side project and it's, you know, not priority, but we'll allocate a certain amount of time per week to it. And that's how we're, and that's the same way, you know, we've done with commercial and B2B. It's like, okay, I've got someone I really trust, who used to be the head of finance, you know, leading the charge on that, Henry Cowie, who's just a wickedly smart individual. And, you know, it's like, okay, you take the reins here and you plow through and you build the team around you and attack and start getting a lift. And he's done it. And, you know, we're, like I said, it's going to be as big or bigger than our consumer in a few years.
That's amazing. And so one of our loyal listeners, Frank Kalberg, wants to know what you do when you feel stressed. And you've talked in the past about your wife and mindfulness and how that plays a role in what you're doing. Yeah.
All right. Well, this is, again, you know, I talked about being authentic, right? And real. And so I'd love to be able to say, hey, I go and meditate for 45 minutes because that's probably what I should be doing. But to be honest, I crack a bottle of nice Cab Sauv and I sit down and to be honest, and probably, you know, too much wine or, you know, too often. And I, you know, but again, I recognize that, right? So does that make it better? I don't know, Rita, but I do. I have a couple glasses of wine or a nice cocktail, old fashioned. And I sit back and I, you know, and again, I don't use it as a crutch. It's not every night. But when I am super stressed and it's been a crazy day, yeah, I have a glass of wine and enjoy it. And I really love wine and a good cocktail. Right. So,
there you go.
And hang out with my kids. Right. And I spend a lot of time. I'm a coach of I coach my kids hockey. You know, I'm extremely involved in all their lives and their sports and their activities. And, you know, I'm taking my oldest to the football game Sunday. I'm paintballing on Saturday, with the other guy. So, you know, we're heavily involved with each other. And so obviously that's the best, you know, source of stress relief is just hanging out with your family.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of business owners get just, they identify to, like, they and the business are indistinguishable from each other. And I think that's when the trouble starts, because businesses are always going to have ups and downs and whatnot. Something that you said that I do want to come back to, though, is I talk a lot about investing in options, right? So a small investment that gives you the right, but not the obligation to continue on. So, you know, if the thing in the UK turns out to be a complete disaster because they can't even figure out who their prime ministers are right now, you know, you haven't bet the farm on it, right? I mean, you can always withdraw, you can always alter, you can always pivot. And is that something you and your team really kind of understand and talk about?
Big time. It's, you know, and I didn't make this up. We probably all heard it 1,000 times, you know, fail quick, fail cheap. Right. And that's what we do. We fail a lot, you know, we test things out, but fortunately, you know, our win column is higher than our loss. We, you know, the concepts we do, like our advent calendar, like a couple of years, like 2 years ago, we're like, you know, a couple of us. And I was like, I'd love to see, you know, cause I'm still a kid, right? I like opening hockey cards with my kids and, you know, I'm a big kid. And it's like, how do we do something fun that would be exciting? Like, I own a Bartesian, I've invested, I have this year, how do we get some more excitement? It's like, how about a 12 days of Bartesian, right? So you get, you know, 12 doors, just like the chocolate ones, right? Except not some plasticky gross chocolate, you get a delicious cocktail that we've curated for that day, right? Oh, and so we launched it last year and we're like, it was expensive. You know, we didn't make hardly any money off it, right? Because of the packaging. And I, you know, I insisted that we're not charging a premium for it, right? Because there's got to be a value, you know, you're a customer. We want to thank you. Right. So it's not about making money. It's about, again, showing that the ecosystem of being in a Bartesian customer is incredible. And there's more value than just having the product and just having to continually buy products. So it's like, how do we do something neat for them? Well, we sold out, and then we just did it again this year, and we made like five times as many. And we're already, we just had to turn it off. We're sold out already. And I mean, what are we, November 4th, right? And
so, oh, that's fabulous. Yeah. Oh, that is fabulous.
So yeah, we don't make a ton of money off it, but you know, we break even essentially, and the customers absolutely love it. And you know, I'm happy to do it.
That's really great. So when you think about planning, I mean, and different people have different points of view about planning, but do you sort of think in year-long chunks, 2 years, 5 years, next month? Yeah. What's your horizon look like when you're thinking about decision making?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm, you know, depends on the day, honestly. Like, so, you know, right now we're in like, you know, operational mode where, not right now. Last 8 weeks have been very operational mode for, you know, November 1 and Black Friday. And so, you know, a lot of blocking and tackling and in the weeds, right? Fortunately, I have great, great team members, you know, a guy like Mark Tessier, who's really being able to architect our Black Friday, you know, success last year, and he's going to do it again this year. So I don't have to be as involved, but you know, I'm in the weeds on those times, but now that we're kind of, okay, it's done. Like we've basically, you know, we built the process, it's launching. I'm now stepping back and now focused on, you know, next year, 3 years from now, 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. But again, that ebbs and flows, that comes in and out. Like, you know, a couple months ago, I was heavily involved in, you know, the next gen unit and not the one coming out in 2023, but the one coming out in 2025, right? And okay. and what's that look like, and what does the consumer want, and you know, brainstorming, and you know, how do we create more value for the consumer, right? And so, because we always need to be wowing folks and creating excellence.
Mm-hmm. Love that. So it does really vary. Yeah, that's interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no real path, really. It's which kind of sums up how I operate. It's very, you know, I don't want to call it sporadic, that doesn't sound very good, but
it's like it ebbs and flows, right? And what needs your attention at one time is different than that at other times.
Right.
So what are you going to be doing on New Year's Eve?
New Year's Eve, I'll probably be going to bed by 10 o'clock like I do every New Year's Eve, right? I'm kind of lame, right? I'm my wife and I are like, we laugh, we're like old, like an old couple, right? It's like we don't go out much, and honestly, like I, you know, we don't really socialize. We're one of those couples that I always say we need to socialize more, but then never do. And so, you know, again, I'll say it again, I need to socialize more, but it's like you know, I look at it as like, man, if I have bandwidth, right, to socialize, like I'd love to take, you know, Casey, who's my head of customer service, out for dinner with his wife, right? And I mean, if I have any, and I haven't done that for, and I was thinking about it last time, I'm like, I'd really love to take them for dinner and just really connect, because he's been doing such an incredible job, and I want to, you know, it's not just about, you know, here's your pay and you do this, and you know, so I want to, how do I do that? So I focus more on that, right? If I have time, I want to do that versus something else, and then obviously the kids, and then sadly, you know, social time with my wife tends to be the last, you know, option. So I suck at that as well. I need to do, I think we go dinner once a year, we go out and have dinner. It's been pretty bad. So I'm surprised she stuck with me.
Well, she's got her own career, right? And does her own things. Was it a big deal for her to move from Canada?
It was a huge deal, but she was an advocate. She, you know, as a psychologist building her own practice, and, you know, she's heavily into, you know, mindfulness meditation. She's a mindfulness meditation trainer. So she trained under Tara Brach, and she's done, you know, she has her own passions, and yeah, she, again, very independent. She certainly doesn't need me. You know, she's doing her own, she's on her own path and her own journey. And I learn more from her, I'll tell you that, by far, than she does from me, because, you know, it's the human element that really matters. And again, not to sound cheesy, but it's the reality, right? It's the business stuff. It's you know, clear. It's relatively clear. It's the human element and figuring out how to connect and work with folks and get the best out of each other and vendors and partners and sign contracts and, you know.
Yeah, so I mean, you've built an incredible ecosystem. It's just amazing. I mean, it blows my mind to think you're doing all this with 17 people. I mean, that's just wild.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you even have a conversation with Walmart with under about 50 people?
Right. It's true.
I mean, that's
right.
So then, you know, obviously, I guess the team's going to need to grow, and you're going to need to kind of get. Do you have an image for where, you know, where you'd like to be when you sort of say, "Hey, we've arrived"?
Great question. You know, we've got, you know, 250,000 over users right now, right? Like that are Bartesian customers in the U.S., in North America. And, you know, we're very soon that number is going to be very soon over 500,000. And that's before, you know, really going into Walmarts. It's before going into Hyatt hotels. And so, you know, that number is going to grow in 1 year what it did in like the last three, right? So, you know, where I'd like to be, I'd like to, you know, be a household name, brand name. Like it's like that, you know, fact is most people, if you ask them, and I've always said this to my team, if you go to 100 people in 100 cities in the US and say, what's Bartesian, you're going to get 100 people saying, I have no idea. Right. I'm like, bank on it. And I'm like, that's the opportunity like that. And so we're still, you know, and at that time we were, you know, $20-30 million a year in revenue. And it's like, no one knows about us and we're doing this kind of revenue. So like, imagine if we can create more awareness of this category, this product. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, now maybe it's like 99 people out of 100 have never heard of us still. Like we're still extremely nascent and, you know, we're very soon going to be over $100 million business. So what will that be? I mean, it will be in the billions once people are aware of us, again, most people have just never heard of us. Once they hear about us, they try it, they go to a friend's, they see the drinks taste incredible, the value, and you know, yeah, we'll be that next Nespresso.
I love that. I just love that. So where do people go to learn more? Like your philosophy or your words? I mean, clearly you've got a lot of valuable experience to offer other entrepreneurs.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. And you know, I don't really see look at myself as much that way because I'm just so much in the weeds, right, of my own business. But you know, I definitely do want to do like I appreciate, you know, the time here to talk with you, Rita, and like being able to share any sort of insights. Again, whether right or wrong, I don't know. We'll see. You know, I'm not sure. I could be doing it all wrong. We'll find out. But no, I feel pretty good about it. And again, it's like follow your North Star, man. If you know it's the right thing to do, and it feels right, and you know, I think back in the day, I remember someone saying like, if your family, your parents, your kids were to read about what you did in the newspaper, right, would you be proud? Mm-hmm. And again, that's kind of stuck with me always. And it's like, well, every decision I make, that's what it's going to be. Every discussion or, you know, conversation I have with a team member or a vendor, like if I was recorded and sent on, you know, put out on the New York Times, right? Like, would I be proud? Would my family be proud of me? Or would they think I'm a knob, right? And it's like, so, and again, it's not like that's the concept. And then if you start doing that, it's just, you'll just end up just always doing the right thing, right? And what you feel is the right thing. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a platform really, but LinkedIn, you know, you can add me on LinkedIn. I got to get more involved in that. And, you know, Bartesian.com, you know, my email's there. You can contact me, reach out through LinkedIn. If you're interested in, you know, joining our team, we're always hiring good people. So, and we need help all the time. So love to build out the network.
Oh, that's just great. Well, Ryan Close, thank you so much for spending an hour with me. I am looking forward to connecting and definitely want to meet the team and to be continued.
I would love to do that.
Thank you everyone for checking in, and we'll be following this story for a while.